If you want to make an audiobook, go to thetalkingbook.org. That's thetalkingbook.org. Check out these amazing writers, narrators, indie publishers. Come to Asheville. We record books in a booth. Here's the show.
Hi, everyone. Chris Hartram here with another episode of the Talking Book Podcast, the podcast where writers read from their new books and the occasional conversation. It's a beautiful 70 degrees here in Asheville, North Carolina. My children have yet to step off the bus, which, thank God, drops them directly in front of my house. God bless the public school system. Everything here is fine. Chugging along, trying to live my best life. Dadness, writing, reading, training, recording books for the Talking Book, with the Talking Book gang, and a bunch of amazing authors, badass publishers, nonprofits. Lucky to be alive is all. I have to tell myself that over and over again. Lucky to be alive is all. Today, I have something special for you. It's a little different, actually. I know we always play excerpts from fiction or poetry or memoirs, literary type stuff, but today I have a book from a film critic. Josh Larson is the author of Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies, which is out now from Cascade Books. Josh Larson is also the co-host of the popular movie podcast, Film Spotting. Maybe you've heard about it. It's been around forever. I've been listening to it for over a decade. Josh, along with Adam Kempinar, break down movies once a week. It's great, it's insightful, it's fun and addictive. Me and all my friends listen to it. We talk about it every week. I recommend it. If it's not already a part of your weekly routine, listen to Film Spotting. So anyway, when I saw Josh had a new book out, I wanted to get him on the show. I grew up in a big movie family. My dad managed a movie theater when we were kids, and me and my brothers were there all the time, watching movies up in the projectionist booth. Movies were everything. And my mom, she was Catholic, very Catholic, and she did not care for horror movies most of the time, to say the least. So although I'm not a Christian, I found Josh's book to be really interesting. To view the genre through that lens, those essays. Anyway, I think you would like it. Here now is my conversation with Josh Larson, and then a reading from the audiobook, Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies. All right. Well, man, I'm really grateful that you're talking to me today. How was Ebert Interruptus?
Oh, so fun. It's really one of my favorite things to do. And the Babadook worked beautifully. Hopefully introduced some people and convinced them to go further into horror with that. But we also had some, you know, real horror diehards there too, which was cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. How appropriate, based on our conversation in the book, that you just got back from talking about the Babadook.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, that was kind of part of the motivation behind selecting the title too. It was one of the reasons, is just because horror had been in my head the last year and so forth. And we never really done it at Interruptus, except for, unless you count Jaws, and I think Roger Ebert did Silence of the Lambs a number of years ago. But yeah, other than that, it's Babadook was pretty new.
Yeah, that's cool. And of course, you mentioned Jaws in your book and everything, but of course, Babadook is much more of a straight ahead horror movie, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really cool. Well, like I said in our correspondence, I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm a longtime listener of Film Spotting. I think I started listening like in 2013 or so.
Nice. All right. Thank you for sticking around.
Yeah, I've been sticking around, trying to get as many people into it as possible.
Great.
But yeah, so like, you know, the Talking Book, we're usually a podcast that, you know, features books of fiction and poetry and stuff, but I liked your book so much, and I'm such a fan of your work in the show. I thought, heck, man, I got to talk to Josh about this book.
All right, great. Well, let's do it.
Yeah, man. So we're talking about Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies, and that came out in June of last year, right?
Yep, that was it. Yep.
Cool. And before we get started, I just wanted to ask, kind of to set it up, how did you, just for our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar, how did you get started writing about movies? Where did that journey start?
I wanted to write about movies since the first time I thought about what it might mean to have a job. So I don't know, maybe like middle school or so. growing up in the Chicago suburbs, raised on Siskel and Ebert, getting, you know, the Chicago Tribune paper where Siskel was writing at our house every day. At some point, I realized, wait a minute, people, like, this is a job. This is actually a job.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's a long time dream. And back when I got started, you know, newspapers were still largely the avenue, or at least a avenue, for doing film criticism. The industry was in a much healthier place. And not only did the big metropolitan papers have critics, but healthy, you know, suburban papers and chains and so forth would have them too. So I kind of went that route towards news journalism and just trying to nudge my way from the newsroom into the, you know, onto the arts desk whenever I could, and eventually got there.
That's amazing. Yeah, I remember being a kid and, like, the first time I saw, you know, Ebert and Roper or Route, you know, and just watching that and being like, wait, people talk about movies like this? This is crazy.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in terms of the book, you know, needless to say, you know, horror movies and being Christian don't necessarily go hand in hand, right? You talk about that in the beginning of your book, and that's why I found it so so interesting. So, when did you start writing this book? How did it start?
Yeah, I think it was that reality, or at least that perception that you just mentioned, that was the motivation for the project, and it actually came from outside of me. I was approached by the folks at Fuller Theological Seminary. Their Brehm Film Center has a monograph series that's all about faith and film. So they have been approaching this topic from a number of different angles and have for a while now thought, you know, there are a lot of Christians who do watch horror, but there are also other Christians who would balk at that immediately and say that is the one genre that Christians should not mess with. And so they thought, let's go ahead and write a book answering that question. Why would Christians want to watch horror films? And I know some of the folks there have collaborated on other projects over the years with them. And so they approached me actually and said, you know, we're aware that you're a horror fan. And have you ever thought about this topic? Would you be interested in exploring it in a book form? So I was honored to be able to do that. I had written a post, oh boy, maybe 2015, at thinkchristian.net. That's my day job, where I'm the editor of Faith and Pop Culture program. And so I had written A Christian Defense of Horror a number of years ago. And it was basically, you know, a very first step into having this conversation. And the chance to do it at book length was very appealing to me, to kind of push the ideas I suggested there further, test them, and really get to spend more time on actual movies in detail, horror movies in detail, while working this idea out.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, even though I'm not a Christian, whenever one of my friends or family members in the past says something like, why would you want to watch something? And, you know, not everybody says this, but some people do. Why would you want to watch something so depressing or so horrible or so dark? Why do you want to be scared? I would always bring up something about how, you know, horror movies are important and reflect our worst fears. And there's so much to be learned from that genre about fear, and fear is an important part of the human experience. And that's why I was so interested in your book, because, you know, even though you're going at it from, like, the perspective of scripture a lot, it really helps, even as a non-Christian, help me to frame some of those ideas that I was, you know, debating with people over the years.
Good. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the idea. And there are a lot of reasons to watch horror, right? I was just at a conference at University of Colorado Boulder and did some classroom visits talking horror, and the students there would offer a vast array of reasons, from just the adrenaline rush to this more processing aspect that I think you're talking about. And that's the one where I think, you know, a faith perspective on horror aligns with how a lot of people do experience it. It's a chance to confront fears that we have, a wide array of fears, and in confronting them, start to process them, think about how they might be mitigated, think about how we can live with them. And then if you're taking, you know, the theological approach and applying it to the Bible, how scripture answers some of those prayers as well. So it is a similar experience that a person of faith can have with horror, and someone who doesn't have that background, but might still be processing their own anxieties and fears through a horror movie.
Yeah, that's really cool. I grew up really strict Roman Catholic, and my mother went to Princeton Theological Seminary, and we would, you know, talk about those kinds of things all the time. And I wish that she were still alive, because I'd love for her to read this, because we would often have that debate when I was young about, you know, she kind of had a more old school perspective on horror movies. Like, if it was dark and made you feel bad, and it was kind of like evil, then she didn't really want to watch it. And she, besides that, and my father, we were a big movie family. So, so yeah, that's such a great kind of angle to come at. I love that.
Yeah, and I hear that too, you know, getting out and talking about the book. You do hear people of faith who are like some of those darker, especially like the demonic themed movies or things like that. Like, I just don't want to mess with that, you
right.
know? And I think that comes from a real place of understanding, according to your faith, that these are real things that the Bible talks about. So if they sense that these elements are just being exploited or used to kind of get cheap thrills, I can understand the hesitance, the reticence about that. And certainly there are some religious horror films that do that. But then there are other ones that are genuinely interested in these ideas that those sorts of religious horror movies are exploring. So yeah, I can get that perspective, though, from someone who's a little hesitant about them.
Well, that's why I love that chapter so much about religious horror, because you brought that up specifically. And, you know, even though I'm no longer practicing, I grew up like in a strict Catholic, Roman Catholic family. And so even to this day, when I watch things like The Exorcist or The Omen or some of the other films you mentioned, even though, you know, I no longer identify as a Catholic or anything like that, in my core, in my subconscious, those things still get to me more so than any other genre. So I found it really fascinating that for you, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you said that genre doesn't often get to you, except for you mentioned 1973's Ganja and Hess, because you believe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's been my experience, at least. I'm, again, not from a Roman Catholic background like you, but familiar enough with the iconography and some of the traditions and so forth.
That, right.
And it sounds like it's working the opposite for you. Like, the familiarity yeah. is what makes it creepy, which
yeah.
I get. For me, it's the familiarity. Familiarity is, you know, I wouldn't say it's like homey, but it's like, okay, I know what's going on here. It's not as strange, I guess, as the
sure.
movie sometimes wants it to be. But yeah, then a movie like Ganja and Hess, which combines, you know, the Black American Baptist tradition with an invented African spirituality in strange and disturbing ways. For me, there was that strangeness there. There was that unfamiliarity, which did end up creeping me out in a way that I think probably happens for maybe many people who don't have a faith background, except for experiencing it in these religious horror movies. That oddness might be what makes those movies uncomfortable for them.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's like some of my friends who never grew up religious at all. To them, just walking into a church and seeing the iconography and the stained glass windows, and all they think about is like The Exorcist and things. So it probably
sure.
it probably does scare them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. So then of all the, you covered all the different essays in your book. You covered slashers, monster movies, zombies, religious horror, sex and death. Is there a favorite subgenre, or is there one that does scare you the most if you had to pick?
Oh, good question. The one that scares me the most, probably psychological horror can scare me, because it often hits home the most. And then weirdly, at the same time, it's often the most comforting, because I find that cathartic experience through it. So by being confronted with these fears, and my argument in that chapter is that psychological horror explores our fears of our anxieties of all different kinds. So these things lurking, you know, at the back of our minds that we maybe don't want to deal with, a psychological horror puts that in the forefront for us. And that I find really terrifying. But then by the end of the film, not always, but often, there will be a sense of not closure, but that processing has been done in the confrontation. And so psychological horror is probably my favorite, because it pulls me in both ways at the same time.
That's cool. Yeah. And I have different friends kind of, or different people, you know, obviously experience horror in different ways. And I have some friends who,
and they're going to be listening to this, and they get a kick out of horror because of the adrenaline rush, and they just want to be like completely shocked their senses and to walk out kind of shook.
Sure.
And then, like you just mentioned, the processing, I feel like I'm more into horror where I like to walk out having processed, like starting off and experiencing the fear and then walking out being like, ah, now I'm through it and I know something, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. That's funny. So, okay, wait, just a couple more questions. If you have to pick, gun to your head, Josh Larson, top three horror movies of all time off the cuff. And I'm a Film Spotty member, so I should probably know this, but do you have, you know, three off the cuff that are in your top horror films of all time?
Yeah, I usually go to A Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, as my favorite horror film of all time.
That's right.
And
okay. I remember
that. It's kind of a, I don't know, maybe kind of a strange pick. It's a slasher 80s movie. Some people find it a little cheesy, but for me, it's just that notion of not being able to go to sleep.
Right.
That the first time I watched it, that just like really got in my chest and stuck there. So that's my favorite. And number two, I have The Blair Witch Project, which came to mind when you were asking for my scariest subgenre, because found footage film, which The Blair Witch Project is kind of like the primary example of, you know, I find that more intellectually provocative often than really terrifying, but The Blair Witch is terrifying. That is one that worked for me immediately upon release in 1999, and every time I revisit it, it still gets me. And then weirdly, I don't know, I might have to rethink this. I'm getting maybe a little pretentious. My number three horror movie of all time is a 1920 film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Oh, yeah.
So this very like German expressionist, surrealist. I think it's like the design of that I love more than anything else. So maybe not one that really scares me, but it just looks so wonderful. And there is something sort of terrifying in your subconscious after watching that, even though you may not scream or jump while you're watching it.
No, that's a good choice. I don't think that's pretentious. I think for anybody that took college film classes like I did, you know, The Cabinet, along with like Nosferatu and Vampyr and a couple others, were like the ones that stuck out in my head is like, wow, old movies can actually be scary.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
And I'm glad you mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street because, Josh, let me tell you, I have nonstop battles with my other movie pals because they are, I think it's more common to be more diehard in terms of Halloween in the slasher films. And I am a diehard Nightmare on Elm Street, just like you. So
love it.
Thank God you said that.
Amazing. Yes, you have my full support.
Guys, you heard it here first. I have his support. Okay. Well, you know, thank you so much for chatting with me. Next, our listeners are going to hear you read an excerpt from the book, Chapter 3, I think. And is there anything you'd like to say to set up that clip?
That chapter, remind me again, was this the slasher's chapter?
I think it's the creature features, I think. It's about when you talk about hit the birds right in the beginning, I think.
Yes. Okay. All right. Creature features, probably one of the most fun subgenres for me. Maybe not the most immediately terrifying, but the ideas those movies play with. And the fear I propose here, as you'll hear in the excerpt, is that it's our fear of nature run amok. So just creation, nature itself gone crazy, sometimes because of what we've done as humans, and sometimes just because we can't explain it. Something like Jaws. Why is the shark behaving that way? Movies like that I find to be so fun, even as they're, of course, disturbing too.
Awesome. That's great. Well, I'm going to leave links to the book in the show notes and everything. And I really enjoyed talking with you today. And I'm looking forward to hearing you on Film Spotting. Hopefully tomorrow you're going to tell me Seven Samurai 1, Film Spotting Madness.
But I will leave you in suspense.
Leave me in suspense, and I'll see you on Letterboxd. But thanks so much for chatting with us today, Josh.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Chapter 3, Creature Features. Fear of Nature Run Amok.
Of all the beasts and creepy crawlies that have populated so-called creature features, sharks, dinosaurs, alligators, ants, spiders, and whatever Godzilla is, birds distress me most. Well, maybe not the birds in Birdemic, Shock and Terror, or The Birds Have Eyes 3, The Crowning, that fake film within the television series Schitt's Creek. It was Alfred Hitchcock who managed to make birds truly terrifying in 1963's The Birds, based on a short story by Daphne du Maurier. Maybe the avian assailants get to me in that movie precisely because they're so implausible. This makes their violence all the more shocking. I know sharks and alligators are best observed from a safe distance. Even spiders should be eyed with suspicion. But birds are harmless, right? There's something insinuating about the way Hitchcock presents them in the movie's opening scene, set in a San Francisco bird shop. As socialite Melanie Daniels, played by Tippi Hedren, flirts with lawyer Mitch Brenner, played by Rod Taylor, who's at the shop to buy a pair of lovebirds for his school-age sister, they do so amidst a cacophony of cages. The store is so big that it encompasses two floors. At one point, Hitchcock positions the camera from high above so that Mitch and Melanie appear overwhelmed and outnumbered. An onslaught seems inevitable. Why do animals turn on us in these movies? Perhaps an answer can be found in Genesis. In the wake of the fall, God chastises the sneaky serpent with this pronouncement in Genesis 3:14-15. Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You will crawl on your belly, and you will eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. End quote. It's the enmity that is pertinent here. Theologians have long contended that there is Christological resonance to this passage, that Jesus is the one whose heel will be struck on the cross, but who will ultimately prevail. Yet I also wonder if this is a nod to one of the results of sin having entered the world, that humans and creatures will no longer live in harmony as intended in the Garden of Eden. At times, especially in creature features, this disharmony reveals itself in monstrous ways. This is how I understand Steven Spielberg's Jaws. The great white shark that terrorizes Amity Island in the 1975 blockbuster is not simply feeding in the manner of an apex predator. This killer stalks its victims in unnatural ways. Consider the showdown that makes up the movie's final third, when Amity's sheriff, played by Roy Scheider, a visiting scientist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, and a salty seaman named Quint, played by Robert Shaw, ship out on Quint's boat to hunt down the great white. Before long, it's clear that they're outmatched. The creature even seems to be toying with them. After being harpooned and hooked to three barrels, which should be impossible to pull underwater, the shark barely slows down, even diving beneath the boat as if to show off. Rather than swim away to tend to its wounds, it goes on the offensive, smashing its snout into the hull. Most people see Quint as something of a Captain Ahab figure, but it's always struck me that the great white shark is the most obsessed character in Jaws. Spielberg peppers his movie with visual evidence that things in the idyllic, you could even say Edenic, beach community of Amity Island have become disordered. When the shark's first victim is discovered washed up on the sand, there's a shot of her mangled hand reaching out of a clump of seaweed, crabs skittering in and out of her open palm. The terror of an attack on a crowded beach is punctuated by a dismembered leg floating to shore. In a later shot of another victim's leg sinking to the bottom of the sea, we see a trail of blood unfurling behind it. These are all images of a good created order torn apart. When nature goes bonkers in the film, it's a fearsome reminder that all of creation, not only humanity, succumbed to the fall. Crawl, a descendant of Jaws, considers alligators run amok. For proof that Jaws is on the minds of the filmmakers, note the figurine we see on a car's dashboard early on of a shark chomping on a scuba diver. The car belongs to Haley, played by K.S. Scodelario, a collegiate swimmer who ignores hurricane warnings and drives to her family's Florida home when her father, played by Barry Pepper, won't answer his phone. There, amidst the quickly rising waters, await massive alligators, hunting for humans with a particularly Jaws-like tenacity. Even before the alligators show up in Crawl, it's the water that represents nature unhinged. Spilling in from a lake behind the house, murky and dark, it can't be controlled. The flooding seems, from the perspective of the suburbanites who've chosen to build on this swampland at least, out of bounds. This contrasts sharply with the water we see in the movie's clever prologue, which introduces Haley at swim practice. Here, the pool water is crystal clear, contained within a rectangular space, and carefully measured by depth and lane markers. It's even indoors. Like the shop at the start of The Birds, the pool is an example of humanity taking a wild natural element and corralling it on our own terms. Another category of creature features, then, includes those in which our fear of nature unleashed is intertwined with another fear, that in trying to corral nature, we've instigated disaster. We worry, or at least these movies do, that in trying to dominate creation, we've perverted it and unleashed the very chaos now threatening us. It's the difference between Jaws and another Spielberg hit, Jurassic Park, where scientific hubris in the form of cloning and corporate greed in the form of the park keep pushing the limits until a Tyrannosaurus Rex ends up stomping on an SUV. In Jurassic Park, the dinosaurs are the direct result of humankind's meddling. In other creature features, the monsters are side effects. Nuclear ambition births the beasts of two 1954 releases, Them and Godzilla. In the latter, hydrogen bomb testing off the coast of Japan awakens a 200-foot-tall lizard-like behemoth that could hold a T-Rex in the palm of its claw. In Them, we're in the desert of New Mexico, not far from the site of the world's first atomic bomb test. The movie opens with low-angle shots of spiky, unsettling Joshua trees standing like aliens against the sky. Nature is later depicted as an intimidating force with a dust storm, as well as frequent references by the characters to the suffocating heat. All of this suggests an inhospitable environment on the verge of monstrousness. And so when humans push the envelope by introducing radiation, it's no surprise that the results are Cadillac-sized ants with a taste for flesh. The different attitudes these movies take toward their respective calamities is telling. Coming from Japan, where the bombs fell, Godzilla plays like a lament. Note the tracking shots along lines of wounded and weary citizens, obvious stand-ins for the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Them, from the country that dropped those bombs, offers something closer to disassociation, if not abdication of responsibility. Quote, if these monsters got started as a result of the first atomic bomb in 1945, what about all the others that have been exploded since then? End quote. That's an FBI agent played by James Arness, asking at the movie's climax. The entomology expert on hand, played by Edmund Gwenn, offers only this. When man entered the atomic age, he opened a door into a new world. What we eventually find in that new world, nobody can predict. End quote. In the decades since 1954, environmental anxiety has joined nuclear anxiety as one of the existential terrors of modern life. In Korean filmmaker Bong Joon-ho's 2007 film The Host, an American military scientist played by Scott Wilson, who's based in Korea, carelessly dumps hundreds of bottles of formaldehyde down a drain leading to the Han River. He offers a blasé, them-like excuse to his nervous Korean assistant. Quote, the Han is very broad, Mr. Kim. Let's try and be broad-minded about this. End quote. A few years later, a bizarre creature emerges to terrorize the city. Like Bong's 2019 Best Picture winner, Parasite, The Host is many things, broad comedy, political satire, Godzilla homage. But my favorite element is that creature. With a long serpentine tail that slinks around victims, allowing the monster to carry them to its lair, this amphibious beast, about the size of a bus, can gracefully slide through the water or scamper across the ground. That tail also allows it to swing from the underside of the expansive bridges that cross the Han River. Multiple mandibles, meanwhile, hold endless fleshy layers and rows of jagged teeth. The CGI details may not have aged well, they rarely do, but that doesn't take away from the creature's strange beauty. All in all, it's like a cute little tadpole or one of the canned squids we see a character eating early on. if it had been raised in Jurassic Park's labs. Similarly awesome creatures turn up in the book of Job. When God wants to remind Job of God's great power, a couple of monsters are offered as visual aids. There's something reminiscent of the host and Godzilla in the description of the Leviathan in Job 41:12 through 14. Quote, "I will not fail to speak of Leviathan's limbs, its strength, and its graceful form. Who can strip off its outer coat? Who can penetrate its double coat of armor? Who dares open the doors of its mouth, ringed about with fearsome teeth?" End quote. The behemoth, as described in Job 40:16 through 18, could easily stand in for one of Jurassic Park's marauding dinosaurs. Quote, "What strength it has in its loins! What power in the muscles of its belly! Its tail sways like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are close-knit. Its bones are tubes of bronze. Its limbs like rods of iron." End quote. In the face of these creatures, in the face of creation, God demands humility. Something similar is demanded of us while watching movies like Jaws, Jurassic Park, or even Crawl. In her book, The Face of the Deep, A Theology of Becoming, Catherine Keller writes at length about the way the book of Job reorders our understanding of our place within creation, even as bearers of the image of God. Quote, "Christian interpreters may appreciate the sun and the stars as evidence of omnipotent order, but animals, especially wild ones, have always posed a gamey embarrassment to human dominion. For non-human animals do all the procreating and eating that humans do. They resemble us, but do not speak. In Job, they break silence." End quote. In Creature Features, they roar. Yet if our fear while watching such movies is rooted in our inability to dominate these behemoths and leviathans, it's a faithless fear. The cultural mandate of Genesis 1:26 through 28, despite language like rule over and subdue in certain translations, is a charge of stewardship, not dominance and control. We are called to bring about creation's flourishing, not its submission. As Keller writes, referencing the use of dominion in the King James Version of Genesis, quote, "When we mistake dominion for dominance, we fail in our responsibility as caretakers for the earth. Ipso facto, we abdicate dominion." End quote. Returning to the birds, are Melanie's caged lovebirds a case of mistaking dominion for dominance? Hitchcock's film stands as something of a bridge between the two types of creature features we've discussed. While there are hints that humanity may be at fault for the chaos, in the manner of the host in Jurassic Park, this could also be a Jaws-like instance of fallen nature gone berserk. On the one hand, the movie is immediately uneasy about how birds are treated. In that shop at the start of the film, Mitch asks Melanie, "Doesn't this make you feel awful, having all these poor little innocent creatures caged up like this?" End quote. She doesn't seem to mind, considering she later buys a pair of lovebirds for Mitch's little sister Kathy, played by Veronica Cartwright, in a coy attempt to woo Mitch. While she's driving them out to his family's house in the seaside town of Bodega Bay, there's a comic shot of the obviously fake caged birds on the floor of the car, leaning from side to side in unison as Melanie careens along the swerving coastal roads. Like the fur coat she sports for the first half of the film, it's an instance of the creaturely world being bent to human whims. Further supporting the idea that the bird assaults are part of a coordinated revenge plot, beginning with a seagull pecking at Melanie as she tries to pilot the lovebirds across the bay by rowboat, comes this bit of philosophy, offered by a local birder, played by Ethel Griffies, to Melanie in Bodega Bay's diner. Quote, "Birds are not aggressive creatures, miss. They bring beauty into the world. It is mankind, rather, who insists upon making it difficult for life to exist on this planet." End quote. If we take the other reading, that the swarms are not acts of vengeance but simply nature gone berserk, it's still an interpretation that we should hold with humility. There is violence in the birds, but the eeriest, most troubling images to me are those in which the winged creatures stoically take up human space, imposing, often in feathery masses, their presence on markers of civilization. This happens early on with shots of birds lined up along power lines, even more birds than usual. There's a cheeky instance of it when birds pop the balloons at a birthday party. And it's the cornerstone of the film's bravura sequence, in which Melanie sits at a bench in front of a playground with a jungle gym behind her. Hitchcock and editor George Tomasini proceed to conduct a masterclass in suspense. At first, a single crow lands on the structure behind her. This is followed by a closer shot of just Melanie as she lights a cigarette without the playground in the frame. The next shot is of the jungle gym itself, now with four birds on it. Back and forth we go, from Melanie to the playground, with more birds each time, until we get a point of view shot from Melanie's perspective as she watches a lone crow flapping in the sky and coming to rest on the playground, where the crows now number in the hundreds. In the birds, our illusion of human dominion gets pecked away bit by terrifying bit. Like the Book of Job, the birds puts humanity in our proper place. After that earth-shaking biblical monologue, leaving Joe in a repentant puddle, something like Melanie Mitch and young Kathy quietly slinking through the yard past rows of birds to drive away from Bodega Bay, God offers a final word of grace. He restores and even doubles Job's fortunes, including the creatures in his herds, blesses him with sons and daughters, and lets him live to be an old man and full of years. If Melanie and Mitch hope to have the same, perhaps they shouldn't have let Kathy bring those caged lovebirds on their escape.
Okay, there you go. That was my conversation with Josh Larson and an excerpt from his book, Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies. You can get it everywhere books are sold. I'll leave links in the show notes. As you probably noticed, Josh narrates his own audiobook, which is great. If you want to make an audiobook or read for this show, hit me up at thetalkingbook.org. That's thetalkingbook.org. We're nestled deep in the Appalachian Mountains in Asheville, North Carolina. It's a nice spot. It's very beautiful here. Come hang out with us. Have a drink or something. Thanks so much to Dave Burr for editing the show. And thanks to Josh Larson, for chatting with me. It was really fun. I love talking to that guy. And I really wanted to lay into him about his recent review of the classic 1989 Roadhouse, but I held my tongue. I held it, Josh. I do recommend you check out his site, larsononfilm.com, and please, for the love of God, check out FilmSpotting at filmspotting.net if you do not already listen to it. You will not be sorry. My name is Chris Hartram, and this has been The Talking Book, Cinema Edition. Movies are everything and books are everything. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Cine.
Like a bishop who has forsaken sympathy, chasing sister squares, I was lit before I knew that you were there. Like an angel who has forsaken certainty, sleeping in the square, I was lit before I knew the storm was passing over and the window.